The Missing Bridge. How many of us really do not trust our intuition? For that matter, how many of us have difficulty with faith? Notice, please, that my own hand is raised. Trust in things not seen is one of the hardest principles of a belief system that has us trusting in God and ourselves for our future. This is the kind of story that Cryon often gives that is instructional within the parable. Here's what Cryon has to say about the missing bridge. Dear ones, the only thing that separates you from the mind of God is the duality that you have created for your incarnation here. When you reach out and trust that portion of your spirit that resides above you, you are using the new gifts of God in this new age.
Henry was on a road traveling quickly. His journey was to the other side of the valley, and in all appropriateness, Henry, being an enlightened human, had asked God to co-create this journey with him. He knew intuitively that this had been a proper and correct thing to create for himself, and so he had indeed created it. He was on the road, but there was one very real problem. There used to be a bridge on the road to the other side of the valley, but it had been missing now for some time. Yet, Henry continued down the road with full knowledge that the bridge was out. You see, Henry was in the process of creating a miracle of trust regarding his future, and he had committed himself to the process of faith. Had Henry lost his mind? What would a normal human think at this time? The human mind makes assumptions. The bridge is not there, therefore I will die. The bridge cannot be rebuilt quickly enough. It was not there last night when I passed the same point. Therefore, it's not going to be there tonight. The assumption is that the human expects the bridge to be as it was before, made by other humans with steel and concrete in the same place as before. My vehicle will not make it if there is no bridge, the human says. Henry, on the other hand, was trying for the first time to co-create his future with the new gifts of God in the new age. He had learned that he was no longer a victim of his life or the circumstances around it. He had taken responsibility for everything around him, including the missing bridge, and was moving forward in a manner that would take him to places he had never been or had been afraid to go. Henry was trusting God for the first time. He was full speed ahead and looking at an empty abyss where the bridge used to be. What did Henry know that most humans don't? Here are the admonishments for faith in this new age. 1. Do not think like a human when it comes to things of God. Think like God would. There's much going on that you are unaware of when God co-creates with you to make large changes in your life. Things that seem utterly impossible will take many strange twists to become your reality. 2. Make no adjustments along the way out of fear. You see, if you think like a human, you will indeed create fear first. Your intellect will work against you in this circumstance, shouting in your ear to turn left or right on your journey, speeding toward the bridge that isn't there. You may choose to stop altogether and abandon your journey due to the steel grip that fear can have on your heart. 3. Take responsibility for the journey. Listen closely, for this is the important attribute. If you think like a human and fear like a human, you won't have trust and will blame God for what may appear to you as a negative situation. Here I am on the road, speeding to my death. God, you have deceived me. God, you have betrayed me. I will surely be dashed into the canyon below. Your imagination will work overtime to convince you that nothing you could ever do will make a difference. Such is the duality that you have given yourself while on earth. If you take responsibility for the journey, then God cannot do anything to you. You are part of God. You are co-creating on the road, thinking as God thinks, unafraid, knowing that where the bridge once stood, there will be something to replace it, without an assumption of what it might be. As Henry sped toward the valley, suddenly he saw ahead of him just what he thought he'd see. The bridge was, indeed, still missing. It wasn't possible to be rebuilt by humans in a day, and he knew that. Henry was afraid. It was the last moment, and he knew that his test was at hand. But what was this that Henry also saw? There were others standing on the road, waving him on around a curve to an area that he had never seen before. And coming into view was a brand new bridge. A bridge that had taken a full year to build. This was a bridge that had been under construction long before Henry had ever asked for it or needed it. It was wider than the one he expected. It had lights to show the way at night, and it moved him easily across the valley to the other side. It had been constructed completely out of sight and only revealed itself now when he needed it the most. Henry stopped his vehicle on the other side of the valley and held a brief ceremony. He thanked God for the power of co-creation, and God responded by thanking Henry for raising his vibration and that of the planet by trusting in the reality of the unseen.
If you understand this parable, you will understand what God has for you in this new energy. Cryon tells us that God's time is not linear, it's in the now, meaning that past, present, and future do not fall in the same kind of linear straight line that humans experience. God is actually building the answers before our questions, just like the bridge. God is co-creating the solutions before we ask. This is done in all appropriateness, since our windows of opportunity were set up by us in advance of our life here. Don't confuse this with predestination. We are on the planet of free choice, but God has the advantage of knowing in advance what we will need in our timeline, if we happen to ask. The setups are in place now for what we will co-create and manifest tomorrow, for healings, for abundance, for partnerships, and for life's most difficult times. These setups are created by God to honor requests that have not even been conceived by us yet. Such are the wonderful ways of faith and what Cryon calls co-creation with God. Perhaps this will give you a different perspective of why trust or faith works at all. This parable shows us that even as Henry asked for his bridge to be there, it had been started a year earlier. Are there things in your life that look impossible to create due to circumstances that you feel are set for life? For example, a job that will never get better, or a family circumstance that can never change. Do you feel stuck with a lack of finances, or are you on a path that you feel is taking you nowhere? How would it make you feel to absolutely know that the answers to these impossibilities are in progress right now, and simply waiting for you to give intent to make them happen? Take another look at the three admonishments within the parable, for even if your name isn't Henry, the story is for you. Isn't it time for you to get on with why you are here? The Big Fuzzy Caterpillar. For children, apparently, this parable has a message that is unmistakable. When presented live, the doubting caterpillar has a deep, tired voice. You might even recognize the caterpillar when you read this. Many do. It is also one of my favorites. And that's why I'll read it for you. The forest was bustling with life. Underneath the low foliage canopy of the ground cover, the big fuzzy caterpillar was speaking to his group of caterpillar followers. Not much had changed in the caterpillar community. The big fuzzy caterpillar's job was to watch over the group so that all the old ways were kept and respected. After all, they were sacred.
Word has it, said the big fuzzy caterpillar between bites of his ever-present leaf meal, That there is a spirit of the forest who is offering caterpillars everywhere some big new deal. Munch, munch. I have decided to meet with this spirit and advise you on what we are supposed to do.
Where will you find the spirit? Asked one of the followers.
It'll come to me, said the big fuzzy one. After all, can't go too far, you know. No food beyond the grove, can't be without food.
Munch, munch. So when the big caterpillar was alone, he called out loud for the spirit of the forest, and before too long the great quiet spirit came to him. The forest spirit was beautiful. but much was hidden since the caterpillar wasn't known to leave his cozy leaf bed.
"I can't see your face very well," said the big caterpillar.
"Come a bit higher," said the spirit of the forest in a kind voice. "I'm here for you to see." But the caterpillar remained where he was. After all, it was his house, and the spirit of the forest was there by invitation.
"No thanks," said the big fuzzy one. "Too much trouble right now. Tell me, what's all this I hear about some big miracle that's only available to caterpillars? Not ants, not centipedes, just caterpillars."
"It's true," said the spirit of the forest. "You have earned a gift that is amazing. And if you decide you want it, I will tell you how."
"How did we earn it?"
asked the big fuzzy one, busy with his third leaf since the conversation started.
"I don't remember signing up for anything."
"You earned it through your wonderful lifetime efforts to keep the forest sacred," said the spirit.
"Oh, you bet," exclaimed the caterpillar. "I do that every day, every day. I'm the leader of the group, you know. That's why you're talking to me instead of just any caterpillar."
Upon hearing this comment, the forest spirit smiled at the caterpillar, although the caterpillar couldn't see it since he had decided not to get off his leaf.
"I've been keeping the forest sacred now for a long time," said the caterpillar. "What do I get?"
"It's an amazing gift," replied the forest spirit. "You are now able, through your own efforts, to change into a beautiful winged creature and fly. Your colors will be amazing, and your mobility will startle all who see you. You can go anywhere you wish in the forest by flying above it. You will be able to find food everywhere and meet new beautiful winged creatures as well. All this you may do immediately if you wish."
"Caterpillars that fly,"
mused the fuzzy one.
"That's unbelievable. If this is true, then show me some of these flying caterpillars. I want to see them."
"It's easy," replied the spirit. "Just travel to a high place and look around you. They are everywhere, flitting from branch to branch, having a wonderful, abundant life in the sun."
"Sun!" exclaimed the caterpillar. "If you really are the forest spirit, you know that sun is hot for us caterpillars. Bakes us, it does. Isn't good. Isn't good for our hair, you know. Have to stay in the dark, nothing worse than a caterpillar with bad hair."
"When you change into a winged creature, the sun enhances your beauty," said the spirit kindly and patiently. "The old methods of your existence will change dramatically, and you will leave the old caterpillar ways on the floor of the forest while you soar into the new ways of the winged ones." The caterpillar was silent for a moment.
"You want me to leave my comfortable bed here and travel to a high place in the sun to see proof?"
"If you need proof, that's what you have to do," replied the patient spirit.
"No," said the caterpillar, "can't do that. Have to eat, you know. Can't go to strange high places in the sun and gawk when there's work here. Too dangerous. Anyway, if you were the forest spirit, you would know that caterpillar eyes point down, not up. The great earth spirit gave us good eyes that point down so we can find food. Any caterpillar knows that. What you ask isn't very caterpillar-like,"
said the increasingly suspicious fuzzy one.
"Looking up isn't something we do much of."
The caterpillar was silent for a moment.
"So how do we accomplish this flying thing?"
The spirit of the forest then explained the process of metamorphosis. He explained how the caterpillar had to commit to the change, since he could not reverse it after it started. He explained how the caterpillar used his own biology while in the cocoon to change into a winged creature. He explained how the change would require a sacrifice, a time of quiet darkness while in the cocoon, until all was ready for the graduation into a beautiful, multicolored flying creature. The caterpillar listened quietly, not interrupting except for the munching noises.
"Let me get this straight,"
the caterpillar finally said irreverently.
"You want us all to lie down and give intent for some biological thing that we have never heard of to take us over. Then we're supposed to let this biological thing encase us totally in the dark for months?"
"Yes," replied the spirit of the forest, knowing only too well where the conversation was going next.
"And you, as the great forest spirit, you won't do this for us? We have to do it ourselves? I thought we earned it."
"You earned it," said the spirit quietly, "and you also earned the power to change yourselves in the new forest energy. Even as you sit on your leaf, your own body is equipped to do it all."
What happened to the days when food fell from heaven, waters parted, and the walls of cities fell down, stuff like that? I'm not stupid, you know. I may be big and fuzzy, but I've been around a while. The spirit of the earth always does the big work, and all we are supposed to do is follow instructions. Anyway, if we all did what you ask, we would starve. Any caterpillar knows that you have to eat all the time, much, to stay alive. Your big new deal sounds pretty suspicious to me.
The caterpillar thought for a moment and said,
"Dismissed,"
to the forest spirit, as he turned around to find where the next bite was coming from. The forest spirit quietly departed as asked, and he heard the caterpillar mumbling to himself,
"Oh, caterpillars that fly, my left feet, much.
The next day, the caterpillar issued a proclamation and gathered his followers together for a conference. All was still as the crowd listened intently to find out what the big fuzzy one had to say about their future.
"The spirit of the forest is evil," proclaimed the caterpillar to his followers. "He wants to trick us into a very dark place where we will surely die. He wants us to believe that our own bodies will somehow turn us into flying caterpillars. All we have to do is stop eating for a few months."
Great laughter ensued at this remark.
"Common sense and history will show you how the great earth spirit has always worked," continued the caterpillar. "No good earth spirit will ever take you to a dark place. No good spirit will ask you to do something so godlike by yourself. These are tricks of the great evil forest spirit."
The caterpillar swelled up in self-importance, ready for the next comment.
"I have met with the evil one and have recognized him."
The other caterpillars went wild with approval at this remark, and they carried the big fuzzy one on their smaller fuzzy backs in circles while they gave him praise for saving them from a certain death. We leave this festival of caterpillars and gently move up through the forest. As the commotion below begins to fade from our ears, we pass through the canopy of leaves that shields the bottom of the forest from sunlight. We gently move up through the darkness of the leaves into the area reserved for those who can fly. Even as the din of celebrating caterpillars is gradually lost to our ears, we experience the grandness of the winged ones. Flitting from tree to tree in the bright sunlight are multitudes of gloriously colored free-flying caterpillars called butterflies, each one decked in the splendor of rainbow colors, some that were even former friends of the big fuzzy dark one below. Each one with a smile and plenty to eat. Each one transformed by the great gift from the spirit of the forest. Like so many other parables, this little one about a simple caterpillar has multiple messages and some insights about the way God treats us with unconditional love. It also speaks of our current earth changes. Kreon chose the caterpillar because we have all known since we were kids that indeed, caterpillars go through an amazing metamorphosis and become flying multicolored butterflies. It's the classic story in nature of an ugly, fat, hairy worm with lots of feet turning into a beautiful, peaceful, flying butterfly. The former we brush off of us with disgust, and girls scream a lot, and the latter we welcome to sit in our hand or nose. The facts, therefore, are common to all, and so the story takes on a special significance. This parable is about something that is real, but which seems to be fearful or illogical when analyzed by the standards of an intellect that worships only the old methods. If caterpillars really could think and hold meetings, I guarantee that some would never go into metamorphosis. They would also tend to polarize themselves politically into the ones that did and the ones that didn't. And typically, they would probably never look around to see what the ones that did were like. This is because it is absolute human nature to get into a groove and stay there if it even marginally works for us. Even in the darkest places, there is resistance to change, since sometimes we burrow into our holes and surround ourselves with the old ways. Through time, the old ways become sacred and the new ways become blasphemous. The silliness of a caterpillar rejecting the change into a butterfly, unfortunately, is not unlike what humans do daily. Not satisfied to simply reject spiritual change, some humans form organizations and evangelistically tell all they meet to follow their lead. Somehow it makes them stronger to entrench themselves with others of like minds around them, especially those whom they have convinced. History is filled with tragedy after tragedy of cult leadership and death, and it continues today. How many people do you know who have rejected something new for no reason other than what they have is good enough? Even when presented with gifts, some either feel unworthy to take them or feel it has to be some kind of trick. This is due to fear-based thinking and decision-making that is the staple of old Earth energy. In the case of the caterpillar, he was afraid he wouldn't be able to continue his food fetish if he left his abode, even to prove that caterpillars could fly. Metaphorically, this is a way of saying that we make fear-based decisions that keep us from advancing through faith to the next level of awareness. Some of us won't even make a trip to a meeting or a store or to a friend's house to examine something that another has said is wonderful or amazing. We think to ourselves, it can't be true, therefore it isn't. Then we go on about our business and remain in the dark. How does God treat us when we do this? This parable, along with so many others that Cryon has given, shows us the unconditional love of God. It speaks of the fact that God is here with wonderful information and energy gifts in the New Age for those who wish to envelop them. Those who do not are not judged. And best of all, those who decide not to believe are not evangelized. Notice that the spirit of the forest, even though he knew of the caterpillar's mindset, did not defend the new gifts or try to talk the caterpillar into anything. The spirit of the forest simply loved the fuzzy caterpillar, no matter what the caterpillar did, and he spoke the truth to him. It was up to the caterpillar to discern if the truth belonged to his life or if he would stick to what worked at the moment. Did you notice that the spirit of the forest asked the caterpillar to do something in order to find the proof? The old methods don't support such a thing. In the old days, proof was always brought to us. Therefore, the caterpillar decided not to look. If there is any sadness in this parable, it is in the fact that the caterpillar leader affected the lives of many surrounding him. He stopped their growth with a fear-based message, kept them from deciding something important for themselves. Many, therefore, would never see the sunlight, the freedom, and the colors. Many would be washed away when the rains flooded the bottom of the forest instead of taking flight to the shelter of a dry tree. Cryon has told us that we are sitting in the greatest spiritual change that has ever taken place, and that the earth will resound with our new vibration. Look around you. Do you think things are changing on this planet? For example, the consciousness of peace. Today, where the ancient scriptures told us that the deserts would be running red with blood by now, there are two countries negotiating water rights instead. Political prisoners who used to be incarcerated by dictatorships are now presidents of their own countries. The evil empire came tumbling down a while ago, did you notice? What about the elements? Seen anything different about the weather patterns? Cryon told us in 1989. That our entire crop-growing scenario will change. See any floods lately? Or winter conditions during spring? Or big winds at a place unheard of in your lifetime? Or volcanoes where they were supposed to be dormant? Think about it. Earth's frequency. Did you know that a standing wave measurement called the Schumann resonance in the atmosphere of our planet has been for decades at 7.8 cycles per second? The military built its entire communication systems based on an assumed constant Schumann resonance. Suddenly, it has now moved from 7.8 to 10 and 11 and continues to climb. Magnetics. Did you know magnetic north is on the move? Did you know that the strength of the Earth's magnetic field is lessening? What does all this mean? Cryon tells us that the Earth is responding to the fact that we are raising the vibration of the planet, and that we have new gifts from God to assist us. What do you think about those who ignore all these signs and cling to the old ways when all around them the planet is shouting, "Things are changing"? The caterpillar did, and he took many with him in the process. Munch, munch.
Marla the Mouse. I was in Seattle before a large crowd of very intense, serious metaphysical people when Cryon decided to give them a children's story. Oh, I cringed, but began it anyway as directed. Cryon said that the metaphysical elite who were gathered there knew very well that young people have many of the childlike attributes of a number of the ascended masters.
Therefore, we bring you a story about a mouse.
Marla the Mouse was a good mouse who lived with many mice in a mouse city. Marla had many things to eat and lived a fine mouse life. Along the way, Marla had many dreams that she did not understand. She had dreams where she seemingly soared in the air and where she felt different, and she just did not understand these dreams. So Marla, being an inquisitive mouse, called upon God Mouse and said, "Squeak, squeak, we will interpret. What are these dreams of mine? For they interest me greatly," asked Marla. Suddenly, in front of Marla, two mouse angels appeared with their furry wings. "Marla, we wish to show you what your dreams mean," said the mouse angels. "Come with us if you choose, and we will take you on an important path."
"Yes, I would like to go," replied Marla.
"You will be away from the others for a time," squeaked the mouse angels, "and there will be difficulties, for there are mountains to climb."
"That's okay, I am going with you," Marla squeaked excitedly.
And so the mouse angels took Marla by the paw and started their journey. She left the mouse city, and the mouse angels were correct, for there were times when Marla wanted to turn back, as easily as it would have been for her to tuck her tail between her legs and return. She did not. She continued to move forward a day at a time, despite the difficulties. Along the way, Marla noticed that there were other mice who had joined the journey, asking the same questions as Marla had. Each additional mouse was added along the trail, some in higher places than Marla had started from. Some mice dropped out of the journey, feeling that it was too difficult. Some missed their friends and family in the city and decided to go back. Even so, there were many mice following the mouse angel guides to find out about the wonderful dreams they were having. Finally, they reached the top of a magnificent precipice. It had taken them a long time to get there, but they were not tired, for they were very anxious to know what their dreams had meant. All of the mice intuitively knew that there was some hidden message within the dreams, something special, something magnificent, and they were not disappointed. They lined up on a precipice and saw before them a grand ocean, a body of water that they were unaware of. Marla had never seen an ocean before and was mouse awed. Oh, it smelled wonderful. Marla had never smelled anything so inviting as the salt of the ocean. They were all very excited, for they knew something was about to change. "We have information for you that will now make sense of your dreams," said the mouse angels. "You are not mice at all. You are fish." Marla was astounded at this information, but she was pensive for a moment. "I'm not sure I want to be a fish," said Marla to any mouse listening. But then the mouse angel showed her what kind of fish that they meant. It was 100 times the size of Marla, a grand, silvery, sparkly, magnificent, glowing fish. She was again mouse-awed by this sight. Then she realized that the dreams she had were of being a fish soaring to the heights, hundreds of feet in the ocean, above and below, totally free, with big, wonderful fish muscles. One flip of a tail would send the fish many, many yards. What freedom to float through the water! Then Marla felt that this indeed is where she came from. This was home. And as if all of them realized it together, the mice suddenly looked over the ocean to see that there were fish there, sticking their heads out, waving flippers at them, saying, "Remember us? We were your mouse friends before." Marla recognized a few of them and said, "Yes, I didn't know where you went. Now I know." And then the guides told the group an amazing thing. Not only is this the interpretation of your dreams, but your journey to this place has a reward as well. Just by asking, you can be a magnificent fish. And you can jump into this ocean, join your friends, and live an expanded life. The choice is yours. Marla watched as three of her mouse friends instantly did exactly that. What a miracle! It was almost as if they shed their mouse costumes and dove into the great sea. Then Marla had a thought, and she asked the mouse angels, "What about the others? The ones that we left behind in the city? Will they come as well?" "No," replied the wise mouse fish angels. "This is not for every mouse. They must ask as you did and be as aware as you were about their inner quests."
"How will they know about this?" asked Marla.
"Through dreams and mouse enlightenment," said the mouse fish angels. Then Marla asked an important question.
"If I were to return and help them with mouse enlightenment, could I still be a fish? How can I be in two places at the same time?" inquired Marla.
"Consider it the being of mouse fish angel training. You will understand it all soon. If you go back as a fish, some will reject you, for they will not see the fish part of you. They will only see you as different and odd. It's a difficult thing being in two places at the same time. It's up to you, Marla. Will you join us?" The mouse fish angels then turned into fish and disappeared into the ocean with the others. Now this is the point in a children's story where we tell you everything turned out fine and that Marla lived happily ever after as a fish. But in this tale, the mouse angels had asked Marla for a decision, and that is where we leave the story. Dear ones, we wish you to understand the point of Marla the mouse. In the new enlightenment energy, some of you will have two pulls upon you. One will be to change and join the others in a graduate status while remaining on the planet. The others will be to stay as you are and do good work for humanity. Not all are called to this place. Make no mistake. Whatever your decision is honored without judgment. Each one of you is alone in this and will know what to do. So the answer to what Marla did lies within your own heart. Such is the process of being an ascended one in the new energy.
This parable exemplifies one of the most powerful and elite gifts of the new age, ascension status. It can also be the most confusing. Many have felt that this new gift is where humans can go through a process of vibratory change and actually ascend into the heavens, never to be seen again. This indeed is an option. Kryon tells us, however, that true New Age ascension status is where humans remain on the planet in a new vibratory state. We stay human, but with the attributes of an ascended one. He also tells us that the path is difficult, but that it is honored and not for all humans to do. It is all part of the energy and vibration that this planet will need to move into the new millennium. We will need to have a certain amount of ascended ones walking among us, who have the vibratory rate from the other side of the veil, while remaining on Earth. They will not necessarily be welcomed either, for the lower vibration of most of us will not mix well with the high vibrations of the ascended status. It is a role, therefore, requiring some sacrifice. The fish example? It's who we are when we are not here. It's our natural state in the ocean of the cosmos. Can we be a fish and remain in human form or mouse form? Yes, we can. And that's the challenge of the ascension status. With the challenge, however, comes the certainty that to do so will cause a distance from many of our friends and family, who don't know of such things and vibrate differently. Because of the change in you, some will even call you evil. The status is beginning to be exposed by many enlightened teachers and will be clearer as time goes on. Kryon chose to tell this as a children's story in order to begin instruction on a complicated subject, and in a way we could all relate to. Jessica the Angry. The transmutation of anger and fear to peace and joy are the favorite subjects of Cryon stories. Here is a story that many women will relate to, for it is a real-life situation that many have experienced and still do. Men, take note, for it might help you to relate to your life's partner better.
Jessica was a very sweet woman, but she was also extremely angry. Deep within her sweet exterior, there was a seething anger that perpetuated itself at every opportunity. It was mad, vindictive, and destructive. It was also self-defeating and shouted to Jessica's mind that she was unworthy to be alive. Very few got to see Jessica's anger under her sweet exterior. On the outside, she appeared to be one way, but on the inside, she was another. And the anger seemed to come out in the worst places and at the worst times. These outbursts only seemed to make her more angry, as if she were angry at being angry. The last thing Jessica wanted in the world was for her countenance to be one of anger, so she hid it whenever she could, knowing that it was not becoming to a gentle female in her culture. Relationships were a disaster for Jessica. Each time she would end one herself with explosive anger, and the man would not return. She could not help herself. Perhaps anger at something or nothing. Jessica was uncertain, but angry she was. After that, she would become sweet again, until the next situation where the buttons were pressed and the anger would come out. It was vivid, and it was ugly, and she was out of control and knew it. Jessica sought help, and it was not long before she realized that her anger was due to what happened when she was a child. For Jessica had been abused. The way her father had treated her emotionally was inexcusable. The things done in the name of biological lust were also inexcusable. Every time she would think of those times, there would be more anger. How she hated him. Jessica had escaped from her home life as soon as she could, and she never saw her father again. Much to the distress of her now deceased mother, she could never talk of why she left in such an angry manner. Mom hadn't been part of the problem, she thought, and yet it separated them as well. Jessica was angry about that too. Her mother never got to be the friend that some women experience later in life. As it happened, Jessica's search for self-help turned into genuine enlightenment. She met a woman friend who expressed the joy, love, and peace that Jessica longed for so much. The woman introduced her to some startling concepts of self-worth and responsibility that really made sense, but that were still hard for her to grasp. Jessica realized, however, that there was more to life than walking around with this anger. And she hoped so much that this woman's new belief system would help her void this anchor of anger and allow her to get rid of it once and for all. And so, on her new enlightened path, she asked her angels and guides one night, "What can I do to void this anger? What can I do?" And her angel stood before her and said, "Find your father and face him." Ah! Those were the worst words that Jessica could ever hear. And so the blackness of fear came upon her. To find her father and see his face again was the last thing she ever wanted to do. She was even angry at her angels that they would suggest such a thing. She had spent night after night running the scenario in her mind of how to get away from the memory of him. Now the angels said to find him. No! And so she asked again, "Angels and guides, what can I do to find peace?" "Find your father and face him," they still replied. And again she felt the blanket of fear come over her.
as if she were a child again. She could see her father's black and terrible, lusty eyes. In her mind, she could smell the alcohol, and she was extremely afraid. Nevertheless, Jessica eventually did what she was told. She said to herself, "I will walk into this, my bleakest place of existence, my father's action that ruined my life. I don't know what it will do for me, but I am going to honestly try to do it." She sought out her father and found, much to her disappointment, that he was still in town. It would have been easier for her if he could not have been found, but that was not the case. So indeed, her fears would have to be realized. Jessica thought to herself, "I will wait until a time when I feel he will be at home. When he's not yet drunk, I can see myself at his door. I will knock without fear, and when he answers, I will tell him what I think. I will tell him how awful it was, what he did to me. I will let him know that he is responsible for ruining life of mom, ruining my childhood, ruining my life with other men. I'm going to read him up one side and down the other. Then I will be free." But a funny thing happened to Jessica the night before the event. As God often does, there was an 11th hour intervention. Like the angel who stayed the hand of Abraham as he was about to face his worst fear, so it was that Jessica was given a remarkable vision. She was taken away in the vision and shown who her father truly was. She saw the overview. She saw two best friends making a contract before ever coming to Earth. She got to see the role of her father's entity in her own past lives, as a loving past mate in that last, a wonderful caring sister in a lifetime before that, and a good friend before that. She saw that both of them had fulfilled their contracts on the planet, for he had come in and committed despicable acts and had been forced to live with them. She had come in and been abused and had to live with that. As best friends with the mind of God, they had penned their lives together in a contract of appropriateness before they ever got here. And they were now living out the play on Earth as designed by both of them. The reality of the vision profoundly affected Jessica. Could it be so? Was this all a test between disguised angelic friends? As if being answered, she felt a tremendous wash of love from her angels, and she knew it was so. Jessica knew she was free. She knew her anger was no more, because she got to see the overview of love surrounding the purpose for her life experience. The Father had facilitated the anger of her test just as planned. Now she could see the phantom of her fear and how it could no longer stand under the exposure of truth. The anger had been disconnected, and she felt totally disengaged from the fear surrounding her dad. Just her intent to face the fear was enough. Just as Abraham's pure intent to do as he was told was enough. Now Jessica, at that point in time, had the option to decide not to go through with the actual confrontation of her father. She knew her task was complete, and she had walked directly into her fear. She had given perfect intent to do the work of meeting him, and she had been honored by the giving of the vision. She had the overview and the wisdom of God. She had disarmed a life lesson, and she now felt incredible peace. But Jessica felt compelled in love to go the final route. With her newfound strength and lack of anger or vindictiveness, she went to her father's door and rang the bell. When he came to the door, she saw a beaten man, looking far older than his age. He had lost all his hair, and there was shock in his eyes when he recognized her. As she stood in front of him, There was a welling up of emotion in his eyes. Before he could speak, she said to him earnestly, "Father, I love you. Thank you for doing what you came to do. You are forgiven in every single way. I am your daughter, who is now peaceful in her life." Without another word, she left him standing there alone to ponder how such a thing could be. Jessica could have no way of knowing that her father was a depressed and despondent man. Long ago, he had given up his abusive ways just to stay alive, but his life was sorrowful, and he felt unworthy to live. You see, within his life, he had his own self-worth problems. He had played out his part and was wallowing in the horror of it all. He knew that what he had done had been unforgivable, and yet he dreamed nightly about a sweet daughter who would eventually come to him so he could beg for forgiveness. He didn't have the strength to find her, and he greatly feared her rejection if he did so. He had dreamed of his daughter coming to his door and saying, "Father, I forgive you." And now it had happened. He was never the same. And shortly he was able to laugh again. His prayers had been answered. He had been forgiven by the only human entity in God's plan who could do it. And he began to feel worthy again. That night, two lives were saved. Saved from the dark negativity and fear that had encased both of them for so long, all due to the wise actions of an enlightened daughter. Many years later, two good angel friends would frolic in the stars, telling their tale of when they were father and daughter, and how they had beaten the test and recognized who they were while in human form. They told of how the truth can never hide when you ask it to be revealed, and how the love of God always prevails over the dark.
Can we really eliminate lifelong fears or years of anger through self-realization? Ask Jessica, for the story is real, and her victory is real. A letter that I received after the live session with Kryon confirmed that the story was about one who was actually attending. Many men and women have come to understand that there is no victimization involved in being abused. The setup is in place, and the test is what a person is going to do with the often disabling attributes of anger and fear. Do you let these emotions consume you, control your actions? Or do you ask God to help to find out what the test is? Discovery of self includes discovery of why you are here and why it all happened. Did you ever ask yourself, "Why me?" The real answer might blow you away. What if the answer was, "Because you planned it?" Kryon says that in the middle of the worst fear and anger is also the greatest release of love possible. The tests are hard, but the rewards of passing through them are filled with splendor and hope. Are you capable of such a thing? Absolutely. Kryon tells us that only the most worthy are here to walk the tests of this planet.
The Infant's Questions. Almost every mom I know with an infant has secretly wished that she could have a fluent two-way adult conversation with this precious entity. There's so much to tell a child. See if you can glean the real meaning of the following parable about a magic conversation between a mother and her infant son. It's a fun story with an important message.
The human mother was startled indeed when the large male angel appeared in her laundry room. "What are you doing here?" "You expected me in the kitchen?" asked the angel. "No, I didn't expect you at all," the mother answered. "Why are you here?" "To grant your request," said the angel, as if it were a common thing to appear in a human's home. "But I don't remember any request," exclaimed the mother. "I hope I asked for something good and that you just didn't overhear me swearing. I say things all the time when I'm mad." "No, no," replied the angel. "Remember when you were looking into the eyes of your son and murmured, 'If only we could talk to each other'? Well, I'm here to arrange that. Tomorrow night, when you go into your son's nursery, I will be there to allow you to speak to him and he to you. You will have a brief time where he can speak to you with the intellect of an adult and the language of an adult. I'll tell you more when I see you then. And with that, the angel disappeared, slightly to the left of the dryer and up a vent. The mother was not frightened. After all, she believed in angels and had been to the local angel shop many times. She had no way of knowing that real angels don't like angel shops. All the popularity had taken the fun out of appearing before people. Some mothers even wanted to know where the angel got its costume. Very insulting to a real live angel. The mother didn't sleep much that night, and when she put her 6-month-old infant to bed early in the evening, she looked deep into his eyes and said, "Tomorrow, you and I will actually get to speak to each other." She was excited indeed. He drooled in response. She carefully crafted what she would say to him. Where does one begin? How long would she have? Would she be able to communicate the difficult things of life? She started by thinking of all the things she wanted to tell a child just starting out in life, about how a stove is hot and a pretty fire can hurt. But wait, the angel said the child would speak with an adult's mind. Well, that would change everything. She would need to tell him how to handle girls and how to treat a broken heart and how not to trust anyone and how not to drive too fast. Oh, my. There's so much to tell him about being a human, she thought. The next evening, the time for the magic discussion slowly approached. She waited with her infant son at her side in the nursery until the appointed hour when the angel appeared again. Nice to see the both of you, the angel quickly said. Here are the rules of the conversation. Mom, you can only answer. Son, you can only ask 3 questions, then it's over. And with that, the angel again disappeared, this time down the furnace grate. This changes everything, thought the mother in silence while looking at her son. Perhaps I'm hallucinating. I'll bet my son simply goes to sleep now. But instead, the infant stood up.
Mother,
said the infant,
it's a magical day indeed that brings us together like this. What a joy to be able to speak to you at this point of my life.
The mother stood up at attention, with her mouth dropping in amazement. She even drooled a bit.
Only 3 questions I can ask,
the boy continued from the crib.
I want to know so much.
The boy was thinking about his first question as his mother was taking it all in. This is real, she thought. My son is talking to me as if he were all grown up. What a miracle! What a gift! She could hardly contain herself waiting for her son's first question. Would it be about philosophy or religion? Perhaps he would want to know the best advice to guide him into a good career. Or maybe he wanted to know how he should choose the best mate, one who would stick around longer than hers did. The boy looked into his mother's eyes and asked the first question.
Mother, I have laid outside this house on my back and was amazed at the sky. Why is it blue?
It was all the mother could do not to shout. You wasted the first question. Who cares why the sky is blue? But the mother was so in love with her son that she patiently answered the question according to the rules. She explained how the atmosphere and oxygen molecules refract the light of the sun and turn it blue. Well, at least that's what she believed. It sounded good anyway. She anxiously waited for the next question. The next one has to be better, she thought. Perhaps he would like to know what he should do with his life in order not to end up homeless or with delinquent friends.
Mother, my second question is this. Although I have been here only 6 months, I notice that sometimes it is hot outside and sometimes it is cold. Why is that?
The mother was appalled. Another question wasted on dumb stuff. How could this be, she wondered. Her son was innocent and alert. His question was important to him, and she treasured this magic time they could have together. Slowly, She tried to tell him about the Earth and the Sun, and how the Earth tilts slightly as it orbits the Sun, causing winter and summer, cold and hot. Finally, it was time for the last question. They had been at it for almost 30 minutes, and so little had actually been communicated.
Mother, I love you,
exclaimed the Sun.
But how do I know you are really my mother? Do you have some kind of proof?
What kind of a question was this? Where did that come from? Who else would be his mother? Hadn't she cared for him every day of his life? What a disappointment this session had been. She almost wanted to walk away and go back to the laundry room where this had all started. She thought of how she was going to shove the angel in the dryer the next time she saw him. Her son, his innocent eyes wide open and alert, was waiting for a reply. She started crying, but held out her hands and said, "Look at my fingers. They're just like yours. My feet and my face look like yours. My expressions of joy and love are just like yours. I am truly your mother. We have the same eyes and mouth. Look." With that, the child was satisfied, and he slowly laid himself down on his mat and went to sleep. That was it. This miracle of communication had come and gone, and the mother had not had a meaningful conversation with her beautiful son. What happened? What went wrong? She spent a great deal of time thinking about it all, and she mourned the passing of such an event without anything substantive being transferred. And then the angel appeared again, up through the bathroom drain. "Go away," the mother said before the angel could say anything. "What a disappointment you turned out to be." "I gave you the time," the angel said kindly. "I did not design the questions." "What good was it? Why didn't my son ask anything important? You told me that he would have the mind of an adult, but he asked the questions of a child. You've tricked me with your so-called miracle." "Dear one," the angel replied, "although your son was given the language and the intellect of an adult, he had only the wisdom and experience of the 6 months he's been on Earth. His questions were therefore the most meaningful ones that he could think of, and you answered them all. Even the last one, which was postured in fear, you answered correctly. In addition, you transmitted your love to him while you were together, and you were not impatient with him. He did his best and was honest. What more could you ask?" The mother sat down. She hadn't thought of that. Her son had mustered up the best questions he could come up with. How could he know what to ask if he didn't have the wisdom she had? And if he had somehow been given that wisdom, he would not have had to ask anything. Without any more communication, the angel left for the final time, this time out the window. The mother returned to the crib and spent a long time looking at her precious son. "You did your best, my son," she said in a quiet voice. "It was good that we had time for a talk."
So, did you get the real meaning of this fun little story? You and I do not have the mind of God while we are here on this planet, and yet we have the gift of being able to speak with the masters. How patient they must be with us as we flounder around with questions that have no bearing on the real reasons we're here. How can we know what to ask? Kryon gave us the magic question right after this story was given in live session, coming in a moment. The interesting thing about this story is that God answers our questions even if they are meaningless to our lives or to the planet's purpose. Have you ever read a book about the lineage of the vast amounts of entities around us? There are some books that will give you chapter and verse, the names and the battles and how Earth came to be. It tells who the players were and what happened to them long before there was ever an atmosphere on the planet. And if you read these books, did they give you a warm, fuzzy feeling inside? Did they make you understand what to do with your life? Do you now have a clear direction about which way to turn to solve the problems of being a human in this new age? I'll bet not. Your book just gave you the answer to the metaphysical child's question, "Why is the sky blue?" So many times we are compelled to ask God to prove that God is God. "Show me this, and show me that." How can I know you are real? How can I know you are God? This is when made in his image is often explained. And it's when we get to understand the metaphor of love with the image of God being the imprint of love and compassion we each come in with. Think of how insulting this question is for the angels and for the exalted ones who have been with us at our side from birth. And yet the answers are always compassionate and loving. Even these answers, however, don't get us from A to B, nor do they help us through unsatisfying relationships, meaningless jobs, health problems, financial issues, or family and community difficulties. Cryon tells us that there is only one real question that can make a difference in our lives and change us dramatically. When we sit before God in meditation and prayer, there's a two-way communication going. Some say that prayer is when we speak to God and meditation is when we listen. The next time you have the opportunity to speak and listen, ask the following question. Dear God, what is it you wish me to know? There is no greater question than this, and it reflects your wisdom of spiritual awareness like no other. If the child had asked this, the mother would still be answering to this day, and the child would have been far wiser in his growth. The Two Groups of Warriors. This short little parable is one of my favorites. Much is hidden here regarding what we are supposed to do with the gifts of God in this new age.
It seems that there were two groups of warriors on a certain place on the planet Earth. Each group knew of the new gifts of God in the new age, and each group was comprised of warriors of the light. They understood their contracts. And they knew that there were dark forces at work that would like to prevent them from completing their personal goals. So they called on God for the gifts of the new energy, and each warrior received his package as requested. Each package given to the warriors was personal, and each contained three items: a sword, a shield, and some body armor. The sword represented truth and could never be broken. Truth is pure, and the sword was also, offering a perfect defense against the deceptions of the dark ones. The shield represented knowledge of the weakness of the enemy, and knowledge from eons of archives from the ancients. No energy could penetrate the shield, since knowledge voided out secrets and conspiracy. Secrets and conspiracy cannot exist in the light of knowledge, for they depend on a dark place of ignorance for their power. The body armor represented the mantle of the Spirit of God. This was the wisdom of spiritual awareness that gave humans the enablement as the pieces of God that they are. Therefore, it represented the wisdom of God in all things, especially the wisdom to wield the truth and hold up the knowledge in the face of attack. Now, it came to be that indeed there was a coordinated attack by the dark forces. Both groups of light warriors felt they were ready, and they quickly turned to their powerful gifts to ward off the enemy. As the dark forces closed in, the first group opened their packages and stared at the contents with disbelief. Everything was in parts. There was a manual with a note that said, "Some assembly required." They couldn't begin to get ready in time to meet the enemy, and so the group of warriors was quickly overrun and was defeated at the hands of those who would control them. They became bitter and believed that God had tricked them into a false hope and sense of security. Now, oddly enough, even after defeat, they still had their packages, but they thought the tools were useless. The other group had opened their packages long ago. They had put their tools together early, and they had practiced with them. It was a good thing they did, for they found the sword to be almost too swift to handle properly. They found the shield to have so many options that they had a difficult time knowing exactly how to hold it, and they found the body armor heavy indeed. But with practice and meditation, they eventually learned how to balance everything, and they were ready. They realized that no single tool worked without all these three being engaged. The body armor, the closest thing to their skin, was the key, for it somehow gave them the wisdom to control the sword and the shield. Indeed, the shield was used in many modes depending on the situation, and the sword was easily controlled when the shield was used appropriately. When the attack came, the enemy took one look at this enabled force and fled. The battle was non-existent, and the warriors rejoiced in their victory. There was no showdown, and no wounds were suffered.
There are some very spiritual people who continue to wait for God to do something for them. When they need healing, they ask God to do it, and they hope, and they hope, and they hope. When they wish to have situations around them change, they ask God to do it, and they wait, and wait, and wait. This comes squarely from the fact that this is the way it used to work, and the old scriptures show it. In fact, the story of Moses exemplifies this fact. God did everything, and Moses and his people were instructed to go when told to. From plagues to parting waters, to carving instructions in stone, everything was done by God. Even when the Israelites were wandering in the desert, God fed them daily, dropping food from heaven. This was the old energy, before a time when we as humans were given permission to carry a greater energy and ability. When the great Jewish master of love, Jesus, walked the earth, he was the messenger who gave us the word that everything was changing. The age of God's love was upon us. He spoke of spiritual gifts and showed them to us. He gave wonderful lectures, performed great miracles, showed a fisherman how to walk on water, and even spoke the words, "You can be just like me." His message was clear. We are newly enabled spiritual creatures if we choose to be, with powers from the love source itself. Now we find ourselves crowding the millennium, and more gifts are being given to us because, as Cryan tells it, we have earned them in this age of love. Even now, however, there are those who feel the old ways of waiting for God to do everything are still in effect. But they are not. In this new energy, we are asked to co-create our reality. Co-creation requires two entities. That's the co-part. It requires cooperation between the God source and the God portion of the human called the higher self. We are absolutely required to learn the new ways of working spiritually in the new energy of our planet. The doom and gloom predictions of Nostradamus will come and go, and many will realize that Cryon was correct. We are in a brand new paradigm for the planet Earth. As we sail past the time when everything was supposed to end, we'd better start understanding how we contribute spiritually to the entire scheme and find the designed ways to work with God to make this planet a grand place. Those who do not will be very disappointed, and they will not understand what happened. Learn about the gifts. Pick up the package and use it. Understand how truth, knowledge, and wisdom work together to give great power in this new age.